Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, novelist George Saunders talks about his funny and melancholy novella Fox 8, which tells the story of a woodland creature who studies humans from a distance, learns to speak, and dreams of living happily among them, only to discover the uniquely human traits of senseless destruction and casual cruelty. Saunders won the Man Booker Prize last year for his novel Lincoln in the Bardo, another book in which he created an imaginary world to explore deeper truths about the world that actually exists. We'll talk with George Saunders after a short break. There's a reason Aesop's fables have lasted 2,600 years. These deceptively simple little stories hide profound morals, and they're short enough that listeners could remember and retell them for many generations. You could do that with George Saunders' fable for adults about a clever fox who loves humans but fails to understand our random cruelty. A big part of this story's charm, though, lies in the way the words appear on the page. Because Saunders' fox, named Fox 8 to distinguish him from, say, Fox 7 or Fox 10 or 24, he writes his own story. He just doesn't spell very well. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. George Saunders won the Man Booker Prize last year for his novel Lincoln in the Bardo. Fox 8 was first released as an ebook several years ago and has now been published as a small but powerful illustrated hardcover. We're delighted to have George Saunders with us to talk about it. He joins us from the studios of WAER in Syracuse, New York. George, welcome back to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
First of all, I discovered in the course of looking something up for this interview that the word for one who writes fables is fabulist. That seems like a delightful thing to add to your bio.
I like that. I'm going to get some business cards and then put that on them.
So Fox 8 has learned to speak and write English by sitting outside a window observing a human mother reading bedtime stories to her children. And he falls in love with this little family from a distance, not least because he can relate to their custom of the goodnight kiss. From a distance, he feels like humans must be like foxes and must be benevolent.
Yeah, it looks pretty good from outside that window. And he kind of sees us at our best. You know, we're organized and sophisticated, and we're loving, and we build malls and so on. So he's kind of a little bit of a fanboy for humans, at least at the start of the story.
His sense that he could understand people by looking through that window made me think of like the hegemony of American media in the world, right? One could pick up a lot of English, a lot of clues about American culture watching TV and movies, but that's not going to be the whole story.
No, that's real. I just came back from Sweden, and I had the same thought that we have a disproportionate amount of influence in the world. And, you know, considering how our cultural product gets made and the way it in some cases misrepresents reality, it's a lot of responsibility. And I think that's an incredible observation, actually. Yeah.
He's mildly outraged by the ways that humans get stories about animals wrong.
Yeah, there's a kind of a positive stereotyping that human beings do. So he's just a really naive, sweet little guy who is pretty optimistic at the beginning of the story. And, the origin was I was going to just write a kid's book, and I was writing a humor column for The Guardian, and I did one story where there was a very sophisticated talking dog, and then another one where there was kind of the joke was that it was a high school course evaluation that was full of misspellings. And so I just kind of, that was called course evaluation, C-O-A-R-S-E. So I just kind of crossed the two, mostly just for fun, you know, and found to my surprise that the misspelling was actually a kind of poetics. Like it was really interesting to have a simple sentence and work through the different ways in which the spelling could be butchered. And finding out that some of the ways were kind of beautiful and kind of compelling and made you actually, it actually drew you into the sentence, and other ways seemed trivial. So that was kind of a cool way to almost expand the purview of a sentence. So I did that for a while, and it was just a kid's story, of course. And I had one longer version with a sort of happy ending. And then I sent it out to kids' book editors, and they were like, wait a minute, you can't have a book for kids full of misspellings. It would like poison the well. So then I kind of thought, okay, well, if I took off the expectation, at least my self-imposed expectation about a kid's book, which is a happy ending and some sort of positive message, where might this story go? And it went in a dark direction, which, you know, I tend to do. And then suddenly I didn't know what it was. And that's where I love to get that to that place in a book where I thought I knew what it was, and suddenly it had a different idea about itself. That's where the real richness lies.
I felt like the grammar and the spelling errors were a really interesting device because they remind you that you're dealing with someone who is not human, and they also serve to sort of slow the reader down through what is otherwise a really short book.
That's exactly right. And I think that, you know, I thought it was a bit like minimalism in music. Like if you listen to Philip Glass, he's repeating the same phrase over and over again, and you feel your listening apparatus adjust to accommodate that. And suddenly if a pitch goes up half a step, you notice, and it actually has emotional power, weirdly. So I think that was part of it, I noticed even rereading it, there are little bursts of confusion where the proper spelling doesn't come through quite, and then it does, and there's a little pleasure there. So I'm a big fan of writing and reading as a form of intimate connection between reader and writer. And like any good relationship, there can be a little withholding, and then a little gratification when that's relieved. And that's kind of the way I write all my books, is just to find a little constraint for myself and then some way of sort of electrifying the relationship between me and my imaginary reader so it continues to be interesting for both of us.
It's so interesting to me that so many artists talk about the value of having constraints or limitations. It would seem to those of us who don't make art that would be the last thing you'd want.
Yeah, I think, when you're young, that's how you write. You're going to write the great, world novel that has everyone in it and everything in it. And then, you kind of struggle for purchase. I think for me, the principle is that actually what we call beauty is observing someone else thriving under limited conditions, So if you see, in this book, the idea is that you see, oh boy, George has decided to be cute and have a book full of misspellings. Then part of you goes, ick, that's not going to work. I'm not going to like this. Then we're in relationship, and my job is to convert you. Now, without the constraint, I'm not sure that really happens. If you part of your enjoyment of the book, if you do enjoy it, is to say, wow, he did a lot with that seemingly obstructive constraint. So I think, in all the great forms, in the great art forms, there's some kind of structural or formal constraint, even if it's just implied. And I think part of the reason we get into the fun of it is because we pick up on that right away.
Part of the reason that I was drawn to it immediately was that, so when my youngest daughter was about 5 and she went to kindergarten, and they're encouraged to write before they can really spell anything, just based on sounding words out. And in speaking, she still had kind of a speech impediment, but she was very passionate and dramatic. And in my head, that was how Fox 8 talked.
Oh, that's sweet. Yeah, no, I know just what you mean. We had our daughter one time said, she's really tiny. And I said, well, what's the matter? You don't seem happy. And she just gave me these big eyes and she said, I can't know. That's like, but that for me, I grew up on the south side of Chicago. And one of the things when I first started writing successfully, what I realized was that poetry is actually just a full human soul trying to get out through a constricted opening, So in our neighborhood, there were, great, great spirits and great hearts and big passions and disappointments. But you only heard it through a kind of constricted Chicago diction, which was often making jokes or kind of calling names or talking around the real passion. And I think for me, a light went on when I realized, wait a minute, that doesn't mean that's a smaller human soul. That just means they have a different means of expression. And poetry is that moment when somehow I guess you'd say the soul comes fully through in spite of maybe because of the constriction. So that's kind of, when I'm trying to start something, I'm always looking for the kind of almost arbitrary constraint that I can come up with. And then the second thing you do is you look for some reason why the narrator would speak in that funny way. So in this case, the whole thing at the window was just sort of an excuse to get to the bad spelling.
You make was like, as in, I was like, tell him to call me back, into a single word spelled W-O-S-L-I-K-E. And I hadn't thought about how thoroughly that phrase has like entered the lexicon as a substitute for said.
It really, and it has, the book was, as you said, it was written a while ago, and I would think that would fall away, but I think it's getting solidified, maybe because it's kind of useful, to say, if you say, he said this, I think you're kind of implying a verbatim quote, but he was like is sort of, this is approximately what he said, or this is approximately what I received from him. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a statement on the emotional content of the message as well.
Yeah, and you can say, you can even say, I was like, and then you can make a facial expression.
Right.
And then we go, oh, yeah, no, I feel you on that one. So I love, you know, again, as somebody who came from the working class and then went to engineering school.
Engineering school, really?
Yeah, I was a major in geophysics at the School of Mines in Colorado. And then I worked in the oil business, was down in Dallas, and then was out in Asia. So there was all these strange dictions that I was always getting. And again, part of the light coming on was to go, wow, if you read a technical report, it can be kind of beautiful in its efficiency and also in its awkwardness. And any culture that's growing, and especially one that's growing, you know, exponentially, as ours tend to do, the language is going to always be racing to catch up. And there's a lot of fun in that, a lot of beauty.
Did you find yourself early in your career sort of code switching, depending on whether you were talking to someone who was working in the oil fields or mines and someone who was in a management position?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I'm a pretty good mimic. So that was one of the, I think that was sort of an on-ramp to literature to be constantly noticing yourself. Even sometimes with an accent, you know, I used to be a roofer and I noticed I would kind of talk a little more, like this. So I think that's part of, I'm a teacher at Syracuse, and what I talk to my students about is that we all have access to a lot of languages and sublanguages that we might not even realize are literary. And that's the great joy of literature, is to suddenly shine a light on a portion of the language that before this has been considered subliterary,
yeah,
and suddenly say, "Oh, look! These are human beings trying to express emotion or need. How can that not? That's the very definition of literature."
And there are so many interesting choices to make. I've talked with the novelist Jessamyn Ward about this, and she often writes about characters who are really mired in poverty. But when she writes about them experiencing their own thoughts, they have this really incredible range of vocabulary because in those cases, she's conveying that they're as intelligent as everyone else, but they haven't had access to the kind of education that would allow them to speak that way.
Right. She's a wonderful writer and thinker. And I see some of the same in Faulkner, who I think is a hero of hers, if I'm not mistaken. But, you know, the idea that one of the tools a novelist can do is give a character a language he or she doesn't have, because internally we have infinite language. If you are a little kid and somebody bullies you, well, the feeling that you have is wordless. So there's no reason we should express that with a limited language. It's, you know, the feeling of affront or of pain that exists 100%. And when we go to describe it, of course, we drop the ball necessarily. So I love the way that Jessamyn does that in her books. And I think there's another way, which is to make the limited language overflow, which Faulkner also does. But I think it's one of the vital principles of literature, and it's a very daring one, is to say that this human soul is equal to and 100% capable of recognizing this human soul over here. And so literature sort of says that I, the author, can imagine anyone else's situation by deeply going into my own experience. And that's a radical proposition. And it might not even be true, but it's sort of the working proposition of most literature. And I think it's very, I think my experience has been reading and writing is an incredible soul expander, if you think of it that way, sort of a scale model for compassion or a way to sort of divest yourself of the habitual motions of projection and judgment. You actually can change the way your mind works by reading and writing stories.
My guest is author George Saunders. He won the Man Booker Prize for his novel Lincoln in the Bardo last year. His fable, Fox 8, was first released as an ebook and is now available in a hardcover version. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We are @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author George Saunders. His fable, Fox 8, came out first as an ebook and is now available in a hardcover version. He won the Man Booker Prize last year for his novel, Lincoln in the Bardo. If you'd like to join us, you can call 800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. George, you've done a number of short story collections, and of course you had Lincoln in the Bardo last year. Do you have a sense of a really different process writing a novel as compared with writing a short story, or does it feel like just versions of the same craft?
For me, it was the latter. I'm not, you know, my wife teases me. She says, I'm not sure that's a novel. There's a lot of white space in that thing, you know. So it was really the same principle. And for me, it's kind of a lot of rewriting, and I suppose... you know, kind of trying to make one, I mean, it's kind of silly, but make one thing neat lead naturally to the next. And I was writing it very much as I would a story, and then I looked up one day and it was 60 pages and I'd only gotten through about a third of the action. Hmm. So I wrote a really terrible novel when we were first married that costs me about a year of my life staying up late at night and finished this 700-page book. And you know, just to give you an idea of how great it was, the title was La Boda de Eduardo, which I think means like Ed's wedding.
Eduardo's wedding, yeah.
Yeah, and I gave it to my wife thinking, you know, I think you're going to be pretty pleased with this. And she got about 4 pages in and just sat there with her head in her hands. It was unreadable. So I was a little skittish about writing novels and actually very happy to just be a short story writer. So as the Lincoln book was proceeding, I was always turning to it saying, you know, you don't have to be a novel. Let's, you know, be as short as you can. Don't belabor anything. But like I said, it kind of just naturally demanded that much space.
I really love short stories, but I know, like in the publishing industry, they're not as delighted sometimes to receive a collection of short stories as to receive a novel. And I wonder if what you think scares readers away from short stories.
Well, I think it's a slightly less intuitive form. You know, with a novel, at least the kind of baseline idea of a novel is you meet Harriet and you follow her through many years, and basically when she's done, you're done in a mm-hmm. sense. Or you know, maybe she. Whatever meaningful thing happens to her. But a story is set a little differently, and I think its trajectory is more about a certain emotional arc. So sometimes you can end a story and think, wait a minute, but what happens to him? But the truth is the important thing has already happened to him. So I think it takes a little more training. I think you have to kind of have read a few and get a feeling for the, you know, the way that they work. On the plus side, I think in some ways they're more truthful to, you know, to our emotional lives. Things happen really portentous, important things happen very quickly, and you don't even realize they've happened maybe until years later. So I love the form, but I do think people need a little more training in the story than they do in the novel, I think. But also these days, you know, it's amazing. There's so many wonderful books of stories that are out there now and that are actually making a wave. And I think people, maybe because the MFA program is becoming so prevalent, people are kind of picking up that skill often in undergrad courses.
I've been surprised to see the resurgence of anthologized television series, which felt like a thing from the 50s and are back.
Yeah, you know, I think maybe, I'm not sure about this, but I have the feeling that the we might be in the process of throwing off some kind of hidebound conventions about drama that have kind of gotten into the air but don't actually serve us well or aren't really authentic to our lives. And it may just be that our lives are so fragmented that the short bit is somehow more reflective. You know, I was just in Sweden, I heard Handel's Messiah, and actually that beautiful work of art is made up of pretty much pop song length pieces. And I don't know, I'm really intrigued by that maybe and I was kind of goofing around with this in Lincoln, is that, you know, if you really want to know the truth of you know, a moment, you look at all the human consciousnesses who are gathered there and you recognize that every one of those people is having a completely different experience, and there isn't any one completely true one. And the God's eye view is the compilation of all those, which I think speaks to this, anthology approach a little bit.
Hmm. It's interesting when you say the God's eye view, like the sort of one narrator through a lengthy story, it can have the effect of flattening things.
It can, and I think there are great writers like Gogol, for example, can do that, and you still feel like it's the God's eye view. But I'm just really excited by the fact that reality is on the one level, if you just looked at it on a molecular level, there's nothing going on. It's just a bunch of attraction and repulsion. But only when you lower yourself into a human consciousness, things start getting interesting and moral and dangerous and desirable. So if you want to know what plot is just two different consciousnesses that don't agree. You know, so to me, that's a really honest way to think about fiction, is that it's not my job to, to have the voice of God, but I can simulate, what I think God sees as he looks down at all these quarreling little sweet consciousnesses and feels a lot of sympathy for them and love for them. And so that's kind of the stance I'm trying to occupy these days.
I'm curious, as a creator of fiction, do you believe in free will?
I think free will, it looks like free will when you're in it, you know, and I think ultimately it's like a logical impossibility. But since mostly we're in it, then you sort of have to consent to it, you know. To me, that's an argument that I used to really be into it. Now I'm like, well, it's kind of, you know, in Buddhism, they talk sometimes about the absolute versus the relative.
Yeah.
So in the absolute sense, there can't be free will. That doesn't make sense. On the relative sense, it's the most real thing in the world. You know, when I step across the street, I have to decide, and there's either a truck there or there's not. So I'm okay with that idea that depending on where your viewpoint is, these questions have to be answered in different ways.
As in a lot of classic fables, Fox 8 is both rewarded and punished for his curiosity, right? He discovers some amazing things, but the other foxes can't quite understand his desire for more. He wishes sometimes that he was happy with what everybody else was happy with.
Yeah, that's the autobiographical part. I just turned 60, and I'm looking back at myself as a young person, and I'm like, you're kind of a weird little dude. You know, you had I had so much, curiosity, but also weird levels of nostalgia and, sort of ego and all this stuff. And so in him, I can remember as a kid or as a teenager getting kind of emotionally moved by something and kind of making this lyrical outburst, you know, and then having people just look at you like, ooh, what's with that guy, you know? So he is, I think he's kind of a sweet little dreamer, you know, and the culture doesn't, his culture doesn't always, you know, appreciate it.
So there's a moment when he enters the shopping mall that has been built over his habitat with his buddy Fox 7, and I was waiting throughout that scene for them to be discovered and ejected from the mall, right, because humans are going to freak out. I thought it was really interesting that, in fact, everybody's so busy going about their business and doing their thing in the mall, they don't even notice the presence of these two foxes.
I think that's accurate, because I remember, like, you know, I was in the airport, a big airport the other day, and there's these three little sparrows, you know, on the rug, and people were just stepping around them, and, you know, so, but, you know, also one of the fictive principles that I've kind of discovered or adhere to is that as you're writing a story, a first order idea will come to you, and in that case, I think that is the first order idea, that they get busted. Then part of the move is to always kind of resist the first one. Mm-hmm. See what the second one is. There was a wonderful writer named Carol Bly who talked about this, and you know that, and that's part of the contract with the reader. If you as the reader have that first order response, and then I do it, there's a little bit of disappointment, I would say. It's very small. Over the course of a book, though, a number of times when I exactly fulfill your wishes, ends to a little bit of disappointment. Einstein had this thing. He said, no worthy problem is ever solved on the plane of its original conception. So that means part of the fictive contract is that I'm going to engage your curiosity. There's going to be a range of possibilities that rise up in your mind, and I'm going to pick one that is not too familiar or too random, and you're going to be kind of like, okay, that's interesting, and then you're going to follow me. So in a sense, it's a series of decisions like that where the sophistication of my decisions should reflect the fact that I've spent more time in that story than you have.
Yeah.
So there probably was, I don't remember, but there probably was a version where they got busted. And when I did it, the energy was a little low, so I thought, better try something else. So I think when I'm reading a book that I love, I get the feeling that the author has kind of gone ahead of me and prepared the ground a little bit and minimized the easy decisions. And if someone does that, by the time you get to the conclusion, you sort of find yourself in a bit of a trap. You haven't been given an occasion to pull out of the book yet.
Mm-hmm.
So emotionally, you're sort of a happy prisoner of the writer. And then when something big and or catastrophic happens, you actually can't, you're there. You've already committed all those steps along the way.
Is that the same framework by which you approach teaching?
Yeah, kind of. You know, I think part of the thing is to be in the room that you're in with the students that you're with and quickly get to a point of informality so that they will kind of, talk honestly to you. And then you can work very naturally with what's actually there. So in other words, you're not going in and preaching or imposing an agenda, but you're really trying to be sensitive to where they find themselves and what artistic obstructions they actually have. So it is, you know, I think it's in some ways as a general principle, I've discovered it's a good way to live is to say, I'm going to try to have as few concepts and ideas as possible, which would make you more open to the actual reality you're in, whether it's in the middle of a story or a classroom or on the street somewhere. And then you have a wider range of responses. And mysteriously, there's also, I don't know how to say this without sounding kind of new age, but when the concepts are down and your mind is quiet, I feel like there's a better me that appears, you know, in my stories for sure. It's sort of a more loving, less judgmental, less predetermined me. So I found that, you know, teaching and writing have been really nice training for life. And as long as I have another 90 years, I'll get it right.
That quiet is hard to find these days. There's always something to distract us from our own thoughts.
Yes. Or to cause more thoughts,
yeah.
In my case, you know. I totally agree. And I think, you know, my thought is that probably, you know, to have an old fart moment here, I think probably social media, in 20 years, we're going to look back and go, wow, we poisoned ourselves with that. You know, we didn't really understand what it was doing to us, which what it's doing is it's causing our mind to light up many thousands of times a day with facile, snarky observations. And so for me, the quiet, when I'm writing, something funny happens where I'm just trying to react intuitively to the text, and that part of your mind that ruminates goes pretty quiet. I don't know why, it's not intentional, it just happens. And so I find myself really, really craving that that relative quiet. And again, it's not that you're not checked out, you're not a zombie, but the part of yourself that's constructing an identity and deciding and choosing and judging steps out of the way, and something else comes up. It's nothing mystical, but it's just kind of a quietness that has very good sense. And then to be in that mode and keep coming back to a character day after day, what happens is you start giving, every day you give the character a little more credit. And even if the character is a stinker, he or she starts becoming a more three-dimensional stinker. And so, you know, it's very mysterious. I don't really understand it. But our first, you know, I feel like, you know, when you're driving and somebody cuts you off, you always know their political party.
You know, whatever yours is not.
Yeah, right? And of course you don't know. So that's first order projection.
Mm-hmm.
When you're doing a first draft, that's what you're mostly working out of. And the characters tend to be below you and less than you, and you with the reader are looking down on them. And weirdly, through revision, just through paying attention to the language and trying to be fair and trying to honor your reader, that character comes up. And again, it doesn't mean that she's wonderful. She could be a terrible person, but you've honored her with your attention, which in my world is basically equal to love. You've honored her by loving her, by looking at her, and then she comes up. So suddenly there's this moment where there's this beautiful little trio of writer, reader, and character who are all kind of in a state of mutual respect. And I think that's, if there's a beneficial thing to fiction, I think it's in that little moment where you feel the boundaries of self dropping just temporarily. And then you go back in the world and it's, you know, it lasts for a little while, and it gives us an... I think it gives us the idea that the mind can actually be altered and the heart can actually be altered. I think even just to know that is really beneficial.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It seems to me that the people who have a goal for themselves, professionally or personally, the ones who persist are the ones who can just suck it up and keep going, even at the moment they realize that their initial efforts are terrible, or like maybe promising but terrible.
Yeah.
And so many people describe this. I mean, I guess you can't do that if you want to be a heart surgeon, but you know, people in the arts certainly. And I wonder what your process was like.
Well, I was, like I said, from a kind of a working class background, didn't know a lot of artists, and went to engineering school at the School of Mines, and was a geophysical engineer, not a great one. So I didn't really understand how writing worked. So my first order idea was, I was a big Hemingway fan, and I sort of thought, well, what you do is you go out in the world, have a great adventure, and I come back and describe it, and everyone adores you because you're so exotic, you know, that kind of thing. So that meant that the control was being kept on the side of the writer. The writer's job was to be more worldly than the reader, to come in and give her a vision of life, you know. So I tried to write out of that for a while. And I'd been to Asia in the oil fields, and I thought that should be a book, you know. And I tried it, and really it doesn't work. It doesn't work because it's condescending. You know, it's like if I'm saying to the reader, you sit there, you're not really involved, except at the end you should admire me if you don't mind. And, you know, that's like being on a date with index cards, you know, like, yeah, like 7 p.m., ask about her mother, you know. So it's not a relationship. And
right.
Now why do we do that? We do that because it's scary. You know, it's scary to want something or to and so the first order human move is to try to seize all the control. So over the years, I came to realize that actually it's a you have to commit to a relationship with the reader, which means respecting her. But the way I learned that actually was after that Mexico novel that I mentioned, which was a total fiasco, and I went into work the next day just kind of heart sick. I was a tech writer, and I was supposed to be the transcriptionist on a conference call. And it was very boring, and I was very depressed. And I started writing these little Dr. Seussian poems, a little scatological and naughty and silly. And I was kind of writing them out of the corner of my eye as I did my job. And then I brought those home that night, and I was off doing something with the kids, and I heard my wife laughing with genuine pleasure from the next room, you know. And that no one had that reaction of genuine pleasure to my work in a long, long time. With, you know, I'd give them a story of mine to read, and they'd say, okay, I read your story. And then there'd be a long silence, you know. So the fact that she had pleasure in it taught me that this has to be an intimate communication, and it has to be based on entertainment.
We're speaking this hour with author George Saunders. His latest book is a novella called Fox 8. It is now available in a hardcover version after being published a few years ago as an ebook. We'll be back in 2 minutes. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with George Saunders. He's the author who won the Man Booker Prize last year for his novel Lincoln in the Bardo. We're talking today about his new fable. It's called Fox 8. It is available in a hardcover version. It is a fable for adults. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. I want to go back. You know, you said a few minutes ago that reading Hemingway made you think maybe you wanted to write, and of course there's such beauty in the way that he used words and told stories. On the other hand, everything that I've read of yours contains a kind of empathy, a kind of warmth that I feel like is completely absent in anything I've ever read of Hemingway's. And I wonder if you felt that coldness from him and just found it attractive but didn't feel the need to try and imitate it in your work?
I think I miss the coldness, but I love the sort of stoic, clean.
Yeah.
You know, I was just noticing the prose quality. And I'd noticed it years before when I was in third grade. One of my nuns gave me Johnny Tremaine, that book by Esther Forbes. And it had the same quality as somebody who really believed that if you're going to make the world come alive in someone's mind, you had to do it phrase by phrase. So that was I think that was what I first liked. And then I, you know, as a young idiot, I kind of just liked the traveling and the kind of, you know, the sort of simplistic macho posturing.
Yeah.
I kind of liked it actually at that point. So then when I had this breakthrough, I think all that got left behind, but I still retained the idea that care, you know, on the care on the sentence level is the way I'm actually going to talk to you. But then the other thing that happened was, a lot of those early Hemingway experiments in that Mexico novel were just not funny a bit. They were very straight, you know. And that's not who I am as a person. I've always, in every situation in my life, if I'm stressed out, I will fix it with a joke. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a first girlfriend who said, "I'm going to have to break up with you because you're always joking." And I couldn't help it. I made a joke, you know. So it's a defense mechanism, but it's also kind of what I do. So the early work was totally bereft of humor. And when I had this conference call breakthrough, it was just like a little wall fell down. I thought, I've been hiding all this stuff that I use every day to get through my life, mostly humor, but also, you know, I'm a really fast talker. My mind goes 90 miles an hour. I'm really into pop culture. And I'm also like, I was a really, really strong Catholic kid when I was little, and I really connected with the teachings of Jesus and, you know, in a real visceral way. So all that was kind of behind the scrim. And in that moment of catastrophe, the scrim came down and all that stuff came in. And it was a very sweet, bittersweet moment, because then when I started writing out of that mode, the stories were definitely me. They had me in them. And they were a little less than I had planned them to be. You know, it was like I sent this hunting dog out that was my talent. Go, boy, bring me a story. And it brought back like the lower half of a Barbie doll. You know, like, well, this is what's kind of funny, but it's not like Chekhov, you know. But I think that, you know, I tell my students, that's the beautiful moment when your dreams are both reduced and put and brought alive in a certain way. You know, like Springsteen says, you trade in your wings for some wheels, you know. So,
do you remember, like, to the day when you were able to solely write and not do other things to make money?
No, because that's in the future. I still teach and I still travel and stuff. So, but I do remember the first, I was working as an engineer and the book came out, and then I got an offer to teach at Syracuse, where I teach now for a year. And so I accepted it, took a 1 year leave from work. And I remember a morning in our house here in New York, where the kids had gone to school, my wife was out. And I was sitting there like with 5 hours ahead of me and nothing but fiction. And it was just, if I had to, like, you know, put the definition of gratitude in the dictionary, I would put that moment in. It was just a rich thing, kind of feeling like, okay, now my talent has sort of finally showed up, and the world has given me enough time to actually do something with it. So that might be the real moment when the transition was made.
Once you have an editor and a publisher and people who want to buy your work, do you have to fight off thinking about whether or not people will buy your work?
I actually have the opposite idea, which is my early work, I think, is probably, I don't know. I mean, I stand by it 100%. I think there's something really true about it, but it's a little difficult. It's dark, and it's kind of, you do have to know something about the short story. And I think, you know, there are many years there where you know, I think not many of my relatives actually read the book. You know, they would say, I bought your book. And then, you know, so at that time you think, well, I'm so sophisticated, nobody can get me. And then as you get older, my life has been so beautiful and has so much love in it. And you think, well, why am I not able to communicate via my art to these people that I love the most? So then I got a little bit frantic to try to address whatever that was in me that was keeping my audience small. And so for me, it's a pretty, I would say, popular success is kind of a barometer of my heart expanding and my, you know, it's actually pretty hard to write positive valences, you know, to show true family love or a beautiful act of friendship is actually on the very high end of the technical scale. To show someone being a jerk and, you know, dysfunction is actually the first order thing. So I'm kind of in a race to try to make a book that represents my inner sense of good and evil accurately. And right now I would say that scale is still a little tilted towards the negative. I mean, the story form also is kind of like that. You know, the if Little Red Riding Hood was, once there was a girl whose mom told her don't talk to wolves and she didn't, you know, you don't have much
the
of a story.
Right.
But yeah, but that's my goal is to try actually get a bigger audience and to bring in people maybe even who aren't natural readers of literary fiction, because at the end of the day, you know, we're all here and we're all suffering the same stuff and headed towards the same end and enjoying the same beauty. So there should be some way that a truly good writer could talk to a lot of people, if not all of them.
So I won't give the details, but Fox 8 witnesses this extraordinary display of human violence. And I think what makes it so jarring is that it's just entirely this senseless, terrible thing that happens. It's just about 2 minutes of entertainment for humans. There's not even a reason for it.
Yeah, that was a weird moment. You know, we had a reading from this in New York a couple weeks ago, and that wonderful talent, John Cameron Mitchell, read the Fox part. And I hadn't read the book in a while, and I was listening, and he's such a charming reader, and he made that Fox so lovable, you know. And about 10 minutes in, I went, oh, wait a minute.
I know what's coming.
Yeah, and I thought, oh, please stop before you get there, because the audience was loving it as a kind of a sweet kids book. And I'm like, oh, my God, they're going to turn on me. And then after that, well, a friend of mine was at the reading, and she went home and read the book to her kids. And they got to that place of violence and just like, stop. And we don't want to hear anymore. Mm. And I said, oh, I'm so sorry. She said, no, you know, actually, these days when kids are pretty okay with violence, it was interesting to see them actually rebel against it. And I think part of it is that it's not, you know, in so much of our pop culture violence, there's a glamorization and there's a contextualization and a stylization that makes it seem as if murder is just kind of groovy, you know, or it's bad, but it's not really that bad. And in this book, sort of inadvertently, because it got converted from a kid's book to an adult's book, that act of cruelty really falls hard. And it did on me when I reread the book. And I'm not sure that I'm kind of sorry about it, but I also feel like it might be, you know, the closest I could get to showing what actual violence feels like, which is the worst thing happening to the nicest person, for, as you say, for no reason, you know. And I actually, you know, the reason I felt I could do that is when I was working in the oil fields, without giving it away, I saw an exactly analogous thing done by some of my coworkers to an animal. And so part of me thinks, well, I don't like doing that, but I did see it. And therefore, if it's in the real world, it could have some way to be represented in fiction.
You know, it's interesting. I wouldn't give this book to a 10-year-old I didn't know, but I remember as a child, kind of a middle grade reader, being very drawn to dark things and frightening things in literature. Maybe because the world around me was relatively safe, and yet as you get older, you start to recognize that the world isn't entirely safe, and you want some avenue in which to explore that.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned the Aesop's Fables, and certainly the Grimm's fairy tales are very dark. I think it's sort of like two visions of kids books. For a long time, I thought the thing was to reassure children that goodness was in the world and that hope wasn't ill-placed and that they would find community. And I think that's a valid role. But on the other hand, as you say, there's also a role that says, and this may be more suited to stories for adults, but that says just because things are good for you right now, it doesn't mean they're good for everybody everywhere. And just because you have an enviable situation, it actually doesn't, there is no direct corollary to virtue. Some of this is just luck, you know. So I think a lot of those old stories were actually sort of to inoculate a kid to disaster, you know. But again, I actually don't think this is a kid's book. I'm cautioning people to read it first because I would hate, you know.
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah,
yeah. But as you say, kids, you know, kids can... I remember reading, well, seeing Bambi, you know, or actually one time when I was in sixth grade or something, I somehow got into see Dirty Harry.
Oh, you know, goodness.
Which is totally inappropriate. It might be why my stories are so weird, but, you know, having kind of a double vision, like, oh, God, I wish I wasn't in here, and wow, this is really, what, you know? I think, you know, that in some ways, when I look back at my youth, the reason I'm an artist now is because I had a few artistic experiences that were just too much, you know? That were just, you couldn't deny that something was actually happening to your body that was out of your control. And that's pretty intoxicating to see that you could be roused from your usual torpor by someone else writing words or showing images. And I think that's where I first got the bug. And it wasn't through a book that was reasonable and reassuring. It was through, you know, finding myself in the wrong work of art, you know, and desperately wanting to get out while not being able to.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. When you're working with students, I don't know if they're mostly grad students, mostly undergrads, how much do you think it's your responsibility to gently divert people to other careers if it doesn't look like they are going to blossom?
Well, at Syracuse, we get 650 applications a year for six places.
Okay.
So none of those kids have to be diverted. You know, they've already, and in general, you know, I don't have a lot of confidence in my ability to predict. And I look at my own trajectory and I think, well, if I had applied to grad school a year earlier, I'd have been laughed out of the place, you know. And I've seen people who didn't do anything while they're here suddenly blossoms. So my feeling is once in our program, once they get here, they are getting 100% of our confidence and faith. And just because that's the most nurturing thing. Flannery O'Connor had a very funny line where she said, you know, do you think creative writing programs discourage writers? And she said, not enough of them. but I actually, you know, I like that. It's a funny line. And I certainly have felt that sometimes. But with our students, they're so dear and they're so talented. And you see that anything can happen with them. So I'm more about encouraging. And also the other thing is to make sure that the six kids come in a year, they should never, ever know that there's a favorite, if there is, because that doesn't help their growth. So the idea is complete, you know, equality and rooting for everybody equally, and also being demanding of everyone equally and calling them out and editing their work closely. And it's a dream job.
I would think it would be incredibly hard not to demonstrate if you have a favorite or one that you really just can't connect with for whatever reason.
Yeah, it is hard. But it's a constructed move that you do, partly by controlling your social life, but also by controlling the level of effort. And I've had so many things, you know, I guess after teaching this long, it's not really about, it is about improving their work, but it's more about finding out what's obstructing them. And through the means of editing their stories, you can sometimes open people up to who they really are. That goal is equally lovely for everybody. Even if there's a kid who's never going to publish, if you can get her to, open up, you know, that's wonderful. And so for me, it was always, when you first start teaching, I think there's a little bit of a temptation to use the power to play favorites. And then you see that that is hurtful. And it also... I don't know how to describe it. I think, partly from having our daughters, I think you just feel like when you have kids, you feel like, please, world, be nice to them. Give them the best chance you can. Give them a lot of freedom to do what they need to do. And I found that feeling was transferring to students a little bit. Like, why would I be the one to judge them or to favor them? I'm there to, you know, to nurture them.
Why is it harder to write about love than about violence?
I don't know. It's a great mystery. I think it has to do with this. As I said, with the story form. Because if I say, "Once upon a time, everything went pretty well," somehow that isn't interesting. So I think maybe way back when stories had a primarily cautionary function, mm-hmm. Was don't go into the swamp. So I think that might be part of it. And I also think something. There's a really wonderful book by an Irish journalist whose name I'm forgetting, but the book is called "Kill the Normies." And she makes the case that Western art took a turn somewhere in maybe the 18th century or 19th, where the artist was a freak in love with darkness, a nihilist, And now she's saying we reached a dead end. And if an art doesn't acknowledge the beauty and the functionality that we're capable of, then it's not a complete art form.
The newest book by author George Saunders is Foxate. It's a fable for adults, released recently in a hardcover version. George, it's really always a pleasure. Thanks so much for making time for us.
Oh, I love talking to you, Chris. Thank you so much, and happy holidays.
You too. You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think. Use your favorite podcast app to subscribe to the Think podcast and check out upcoming shows at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.